to Yvonne's
Blog
new...
Talk Radio. 4, 3.
Welcome to Iran's news briefing, episode 4, and I still have not come up with a final name for this series of podcasts. We will get there, but welcome everybody. We've got a few things. As those of you know, this is a slightly different format in that we are going to focus on shorter analysis, quick analysis of news. News that's happening right now, or news that's happening today, this week, as we speak, whatever. I am going to, while we do this, I am going to monitor the election in Alabama and see if we get results. I still don't have anything, but polls, I think, closed 1 minute ago. I haven't seen any exit polling or anything like that to suggest where it's going to be. Maybe within the next half hour, we'll get an answer. And let's see, this gives us live updates. So far, nothing. Okay, if we get an answer, we'll talk about that. We're going to talk about that anyway, but it would be nice to talk about it from the perspective of one of them was won and one of them was lost.
Greetings from stall number one. As much as I detest that signal.
All right. So let's talk about a few other things that are of interest, and we'll get back to the Roy Moore election later on. I think in about 20 minutes, we'll probably know more. Let us start with this claim that Donald Trump made. That every time I post something on Facebook that says, you know, from an economics perspective, Donald Trump is not very good, people immediately respond back to me, stock market's up. The stock market's at record levels. It's never been so high. And that is such an ignorant answer. For so many reasons. I thought I would talk about that. Talk about that first. Let's see if we can actually. I had a table here of presidents and stock market performance, and of course, it's gone into oblivion. There it is. Seems to be loading again. So, what do we make of this idea that the stock market is up, and therefore it's a sign that Donald Trump's economic policies wonderful. Well, first, I'd say no president has that much impact. No president had that much economic impact. Presidents usually have very little economic impact. And if they have an impact, it's longer term. The idea that the stock market here is going up all because of stuff that Donald Trump has done is absurd and ridiculous. Indeed, the stock market has been going up almost nonstop since March of 2009. And if you remember, who came into office in January 2009? Wait. Oh, yeah, Barack Obama came into office in March of 2009, in January of 2009. And then the stock market, starting in March, basically went up nonstop. And all you see today is that Donald Trump, it's just continued, because nothing dramatic has changed in the economy. And we'll talk, I mean, Donald Trump has something to do with this. Tax policy, certainly. Deregulation has something to do with this. But not a dramatic impact. It's not a huge, overwhelming impact. This is a continuation of a trend that started in March of 2009. Indeed, if you look at Donald Trump's returns since he became president, the stock market's up 13.64%. If you annualize that, that's about 15%. That's 15.38%. President Obama, over the 8 years that he was president, the stock market went up on average, annualized return, 16.25%. Basically, Obama beat Trump by 1%. His cumulative return of the entire presidency was 233%. So, I don't know. What are we talking about here? It turns out Barack Obama is the second greatest president in American history because the stock market went up under his tenure by the second highest amount in human history. Really? Really? Is that how we want to measure a president? Because the number one greatest president is Bill Clinton. Because under Bill Clinton, the stock market went up on an annualized return basis 17.49%. Yeah, I mean, Bill Clinton, if you remember, and this is the S&P 500. If you had taken the NASDAQ under Bill Clinton, whoa, it is last year in office. Bill Clinton, the NASDAQ went up, if I remember right, 50% or 90%, some absurd amount. Bubble levels, almost, not quite Bitcoin levels. No, that Bitcoin does in one day. But almost Bitcoin levels. That was 1999. Was that the greatest year any president has ever had? Well, if you use the measure of stock market performance, particularly if you take the NASDAQ, then yeah, it is. So get off of this. It's just stupid. You know, there are lots of reasons why the stock market's going up. Among them, you know, Federal Reserve policy, tax policy, which it's dubious, dubious whether they'll get, you know, the actual tax bill will justify the optimism that everybody that is reflected in stock prices. Yeah, deregulation, that's helping. There's no question. How much of the 15% is due to deregulation and taxes? I don't know. But again, if you measure presidents, here are the top four presidents of all time based on stock market returns. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, Gerald Ford, and Harry Truman. Number five, Donald Trump, based on his record so far. By the way, Ronald Reagan, who is one of, from an economic perspective, one of the better presidents, from a purely economic perspective, one of the better presidents of the last 50, 75, 100 years. He's only number six after Donald Trump. Gerald Ford, much better than him, right? By almost a percent on average. And again, Bill Clinton, superstar of all time, greatest president in human history, if the stock market is the measure. Really? Right? I mean, we're printing money like crazy. Maybe that has something to do with it, or have printed money like crazy under Obama and now under Trump. Other people say, but wait, Trump, what's really solid about Trump is the 9 out of the 10 months that he's been president, the stock market's gone up. And that's a world record. No president has, in his first 10 months, has seen the market go up 9 out of the 10 months. And we attribute this to what? And this is important because of what? I mean, that just indicates very low volatility. And very low volatility has many, many causes. And again, is a continuation of very, very low volatility under Obama. Is very, very low volatility a good thing? We could rank presidents based on volatility. I doubt you want to get into that exercise. I doubt. By the way, the worst president based on this measure. Anybody know who the worst? Anybody want to guess who the worst president based on the measure, the stock market measure? Obviously not Obama, he's number two, and not Bill Clinton, he's number one. Who would be the worst president? They only start measuring this, let's see, for the S&P 500, for the Dow, they only start measuring this in 1897. Oh, yeah, they used the Dow from 1897 to 1927, then the S&P from 1928. So it's not all American presidents, but who's the worst Well, the worst, no, FDR is not the worst, because FDR came in 1932. FDR, if you bought stocks at the beginning of FDR's administration and sold them when he died, you would have been up 300%. You see, we have these preconceptions about the markets. No, Jimmy Carter, it's not Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter is not, Jimmy Carter's there. If you had bought at the beginning of Jimmy Carter and sold at the end, you would have been up 60%. 60%. Again, Fed was printing money. There was a lot of inflation then, so 60% in real terms is a lot lower. But it wasn't negative. There were only three presidents who had negative stock market returns during the entire presidency. All right, we got a winner. Mike Dial, good for you. If you know history, this shouldn't be too hard. But Mike, good call. Herbert Hoover's presidency saw the stock market decline by 77%. 77%. Wow. You put in $100, you had 23. And then, of course, FDR came in at the bottom, and that's why, relatively speaking, everything goes up after that. You know, it goes up very little because FDR was also the longest-serving president ever. So the worst was Herbert Hoover, 77%. And Roosevelt, because he comes in at the bottom, it's positive. The same, by the way, happened with President Obama. President Obama came in at a bottom. Right? Bush, on the other hand, George W. Bush, negative 26%. He came in at a bottom because he came in at a top. So he came in at a top. He came in just before the dot-com bubble burst. The dot-com bubble burst in March of 2000. Bush came into office in January of 2000. So even though the dot-com bubble should be blamed, if you're going to blame it on anybody other than the Federal Reserve, on the Clinton administration, it's not. The person who suffers kind of the stock market collapse is Bush. And then, of course, Bush ends his term with the 2008 Grand Recession. So he gets clobbered in every direction. Starts at a peak, ends at a bottom. Just a disaster for George W. Bush. And Nixon's basically flat. What did he do? About 6 years, 6.5 years flat through his administration. So stock market does not tell you much about whether a president is good for the economy or not. So I really don't. It drives me nuts. I want to pull out my hair. I'm a finance guy. It's so stupid. Partially it's because when you become president, what happened to the stock market before? Bill Clinton is number one because he was president during one of the big bubbles, the big stock market bubbles in history, which ended 2 months after he left office. So he doesn't get penalized for it. It's not random, but it's not related. There's no correlation there. Yes, Ron says a president should be rated to what degree they promote individual rights and what degree they promote capitalism, properly defined. Absolutely. Good for you, Ron. Excellent, excellent, excellent analysis. And by that measure, there are other measures, I think, but that's probably the most important measure. Barack Obama would get an F or a D minus or something, and yet his stock market returns are through the roof. Donald Trump, we're gonna wait with the grade, and I'll do a show analyzing the first year of Donald Trump or analyzing the whole of 2017. We're not in 2018 yet, and I will give you my analysis. Then, by the way, if you're calling in because I see a call, I have to remind you guys every single show, you have to press one. You have to press one to let me know that you want to ask a question. So please press one, and then it indicates to me after you've called that you actually want to ask a question. All right, so that was the issue of stock markets. By the way, if you want to call in, 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. 324-3075. Once you get connected, press 1, and I will put you on, and you can ask your question. All right, that was one issue that kind of really gets me mad. All right, let's do another one that really kind of ticks me off, and I keep raising this, and I keep talking about it, and it doesn't seem to matter. And this is the issue of trade, of protectionism, of protecting American industry from evil foreign competitors. And I posted a story on Facebook this week about the Trump administration's attitude towards trade, and this was by a woman named Nancy McLernan. It was in the Wall Street Journal. And the title is a very good title. Protectionism is a negative sum game, and it's absolutely so. Lose, 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 lose. Everybody loses from protectionism. Whereas free trade, even unilateral free trade, is a win, 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 win. Everybody wins from free trade. So one of the stories related to this from this week was that the Trump administration, the Commerce Department, has made a preliminary decision against Canada-based aircraft manufacturer Bombardier after Boeing complained about Bombardier, and the Commerce Department is recommending a tariff of 300% to protect Boeing from competition from a new passenger-friendly aircraft that Bombardier is marketing. The Bombardier plane only seats, I think, 100, so it's smaller than Boeing planes. But, you know, Boeing doesn't like competition. It basically, there are two aircraft manufacturers in the world in large airplanes, Boeing, of course, the name just escaped my mind, Boeing and Airbus. And Boeing doesn't want more competitors, even though the Chinese are probably going to start building an airplane here soon and start selling it. So they complained to the Commerce Department. Now, I post this, and of course, immediately people say what they always say about these things. Yeah, but the Canadians are subsidizing Bombardier, and therefore it gives them an unfair competitive advantage. Now, I hear this argument over and over. You hear it about China. You hear it about everybody in the world, of course, is subsidizing except us. Now, the fact that we subsidize Boeing, nobody mentions. The fact Boeing is a massive military contractor to the U.S. government and gets massive, in a sense, benefits that way, nobody mentions. But put that aside. Put all of that aside. Right? Even if it's true that Boeing got zero subsidies from the U.S. government, and the Import-Export Bank is a huge subsidizer of Boeing, huge, massive subsidizer of Boeing. So the U.S. government subsidizes Boeing to a large extent and will continue to do so even after this tax bill. But put that aside, right? So what if Bombardier is being subsidized? Now, it's true. If Bombardier is being subsidized, then Canadian taxpayers are basically subsidizing a cheaper plane, which means Boeing is going to sell fewer planes. Boeing's profits are going to be down. Maybe even Boeing will have fewer jobs. But airlines in the United States will be able to buy cheaper planes at the expense of Canadian taxpayers. American airlines will be able to hire more people, will be able to fly more flights, and we all will have lower prices on those flights. And we'll be able to save more money and invest more money and create more jobs. Net, even though Boeing might lose jobs, overall, more jobs will be created. I mean, one of the best examples of this is in the steel industry. People complain about Chinese dumping of steel, and Chinese dumping of steel hurts steel manufacturers in the United States. Absolutely. But who does it help? It helps automakers and washing machine makers like Whirlpool, and all these other companies that use steel. Now, I'm not arguing for some kind of utilitarian calculus to figure out which policy creates more jobs. No, I'm arguing for a principle. The United States should not penalize its own consumers because the Canadian and Chinese and European governments are doing something stupid by the way, which the American government does as well, which is to subsidize their own industries, which is harmful for their own economy. Tariffs are just taxes. Raising tariffs is an increase in taxes. It's a consumption tax. All of us pay it when we buy those products or when we fly an airplane. And because airplanes are more expensive, we are paying it. Why would you want to penalize your own citizens? Because some other country penalizes its own citizens. Let's all have a race to maximize the penalties to our own people. Let's not try to maximize benefits to our own people. Let's try to maximize penalties. I'm always against raising taxes. Always against raising taxes. Tariffs are tax. Simple, straightforward principle. And from a purely economic perspective, it has been shown over and 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 over again that if you have a trade policy that basically reduces tariffs to zero, even if it's unilateral, you benefit. You being your economy, the people within your territory, Americans would benefit. So, and then you get the same kind of nonsense about immigration. But, Americans should stop immigration for multiple reasons. Yeah, right. Right. America, if you want to harm America, if you want to damage America, if you want to destroy America, then you should stop immigration. That is a horrible position to take if you care about America, particularly if you care about the economy of America. One of the greatest drivers of the American economy over the last 50 years have been immigrants, without any question. Again, very few economists would challenge that statement I just made. One of the major drivers of the U.S. economy over the last 50 years have been immigrants. I would also say that one of the major drivers of the U.S. economy since, I'd say, 1990 has been trade with China. Cheap Chinese goods have been a huge, massive boon to the U.S. economy, particularly to low-income Americans. Low-income Americans. Of course, we're bringing in those kind of – we're not bringing in enough immigrants. I mean, the problem with immigration is today that there are not enough immigrants, particularly skilled labor. There's not enough of it coming in. There's not enough high-quality laborers coming into this country. But we should be tripling and quadrupling and growing immigration by 70% of immigrants are on welfare. That's complete and utter nonsense. That is a statistic out of nowhere. What we should be doing is driving immigration up on a massive scale. Again, I've said this before, anyone who can get a job and is not a security threat to the United States, anybody who has a job should be given a visa to enter the United States. Not necessarily to become a citizen, but to work in the United States. Anybody who can arrange a job in advance should be given a visa immediately. Anybody who graduates from an American university with a degree should be given a visa. Certainly if you graduate from STEM. There's so many ways in which we can increase immigration into this country and increase legal immigration, increase it dramatically, so the need for illegals to come into this country is reduced, would be a good thing. Again, with the caveat, if it's a security issue, of course you don't let the immigrants in. But in terms of economics, and I'm just debating economics here, not security, from the perspective of economics, immigration, both at the low end, at the middle end, and at the high end, are all massive beneficiaries of the U.S. economy. And the research about do immigrants take more out than they put in is mostly bogus economics. There's very little hard facts that you can actually, and certainly not the case that 70% of immigrants are on welfare. All right, I didn't want to get into immigration. Much more important than immigration. But again, anybody can get a job. Anybody can get a job, including illegals. That's just not true. It's nowhere near 50%, never mind 70%. Certainly, illegal immigrants are not allowed to get welfare. So it's you can't just Google stuff. You actually have to research it, which I've done and you haven't. Googling something is not enough because there's a lot of BS stuff out there. All right. So that's trade. That's the ridiculous argument about trade. And I don't suggest you just Google trade. All right. Let's see. What else did we want to do? That was that. Yes, I want to talk about taxes quickly, and then I want to talk about Roy Moore. Let's see if we've got any news about Roy Moore, any new information about the Alabama race. I don't see anything yet. I don't see anything yet. All right, well, we'll keep it as a live update. So let's see if the live update says anything. Yeah, they might have kept their polls open a little bit longer because it's just, oh, here it is.
From the Paris Agreement has had another indirect effect.
All right. So nothing yet. All right. Let's do taxes quickly. So, issue with taxes. House and Senate both passed tax bills. There were a lot of conflicts between the bills. These tax bills are massive because they're not tax simplification acts. They're tax complication acts. They add complexity, and complexity takes a lot to write. It's complex. So there's massive, massive numbers of provisions. Anyway, they are sitting down now to try to negotiate a deal. It looks like they're going to increase the corporate tax a little bit and then give favors to all kinds of groups in exchange. So this revolutionary tax simplification bill is not going to be tax simplification at all. It's going to be another typical disaster presented us by Republicans. Again, it's got good elements, but it's got a lot of bad stuff. And one bad thing was pointed out today in an editorial, excellent editorial in the Wall Street Journal by Cliff Asness. Cliff Asness is one of the most successful money managers of the last, 30 years. He runs AQR Capital, one of the largest money managers in the United States. Cliff is a really good guy, and I would if you're interested in finance, I would follow Cliff. He's got a blog, so go subscribe to his blog, and it's really interesting. Anyway, once in a while, he writes an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and they're always very good. And here, he's talking about the fact that hedge fund managers are demonized in our culture, which is one of the themes of my book, Wealth Creation, the Marr case for finance, which I hope all of you have bought. Well, I know all of you have not bought. All of you should go out and buy. Go buy it now. And he makes the case that hedge fund managers are demonized because they're not productive, they're paper shufflers, they're speculators, all this stuff, which is complete nonsense. It's all complete nonsense. And then he says they're demonized on taxes. There's the story out there that hedge fund guys don't pay taxes, or they don't pay a lot of taxes because there's something called carried interest. Carried interest is something that hedge funds and private equity funds have. And it's a way to compensate what you get at the end of the year as a hedge fund manager or as a private equity fund manager. Is you get something between 10 to 20%, sometimes more than 20%, depending on the deal you have with your investors. You get, at the end of the year, you get X percent of profits. And that X percent of profits, if it was derived from long-term positions, or is taxed at the long-term capital gains rate, which is significantly lower than the regular income. However, if it was derived from short-term capital gains trading, you pay the regular income rate. You pay short-term capital gains, which is the same as regular income. Sorry to get technical with you guys, but taxes are technical. And the fact is that in spite of the demonization of hedge funds, the fact is that hedge fund guys own almost all of their carried interest is short-term capital gains. So they pay regular income on it. Regular income on it. So most of the hedge fund guys are based in, where are they based? They're based in New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and California. So not only do they pay 39.6, 3% Obamacare tax, plus in California, 13%. So they are paying more than 50%. And yet, continuously, the language is, oh, these guys are bad guys. They're not paying any more taxes. We need to bump their taxes up. And indeed, in the bill, what they are doing is they're going to leave this carried interest, capital gains, this lower rate for long-term capital gains for private equity. They're going to keep it for them. All their carried interest, by the way, is long-term capital gains. But they're not going to keep it for hedge fund guys. So even though it only affects some income of hedge funds, they're going to get nailed. And hedge funds are going to see a significant, well, or maybe an insignificant, where everybody else is going to get a tax reduction, hedge funds are going to see a tax increase. Full disclosure. I am a founder and a partner in a hedge fund. So my taxes from that hedge fund are going up significantly because of this tax bill. Well, not significantly, because most of us is short-term capital gains. Anyway, but they're going up. I'm not going to see a tax cut. I'm going to see a tax increase because of this. Ah. So I recommend the article because he gives a lot of facts. He gives a lot of interesting things. But I think the other point about taxes, about the tax, so-called tax reform, is the complete corruption of the process. Every day I read on the news, this pressure group wants them to increase this. That pressure group wants a cut there. Taxes should not be used to favor anybody. Taxes should not be used to manipulate our behavior. Taxes should not be used to manipulate the economy. Taxes should not be used as a form of central planning. If you have to raise taxes because you've got all this spending you're committed to, it should be focused on revenue and revenue only. You should raise the minimal amount at the minimal rate, the simplest way, in the flattest way possible. And nothing about this tax bill is a pro-individual rights or pro-anything tax bill. Yes, corporate taxes go down. Yay! But everything else is a mess, a disaster, and just a complexity upon complexity and a continuation and a perpetuation, is that a word, to perpetuate, of a completely corrupt tax methodology. Oh, there we go again. The same taxes, the same tax schemes of the Obama administration and previous administrations that continue. Okay, quickly on this, more stuff. I don't know who's going to win. It doesn't say. It's the first results haven't really rolled in. And anything they're saying here is just speculation. CBS News is saying the numbers just generally are not there for Doug Jones. It looks like Roy Moore is going to win this election. I think that is a massive travesty. I think this is a disgraceful day for the Republican Party. I think it was a disgrace and an abomination that this man was ever allowed to become the Republican nominee. That the Alabamans, you should be ashamed of yourself for making him the Republican nominee. And now if he's been elected to the Senate, I mean, what are Republicans going to do? They're going to start an ethics investigation immediately because of these allegations that he, you know, these allegations about, sexual harassing a 14-year-old and, you know, dating teenagers when he was in his 30s, which the dating teenagers is less offensive to me than sexual harassment and being violent with a 14-year-old, but a groping a 14-year-old. I mean, assuming a teenager means 17, 18, 19, not 14. 14 is ridiculous. It's criminal. But let me add that my main objection to Roy Moore is that he is a theocrat of the worst kind. I mean, he makes Jeff Sessions, who is a theocrat as well, who's the Justice Secretary, right? Secretary of Justice. He makes him look like a secularist. This guy has no respect for the rule of law, has basically spat in the face of the Supreme Court of the United States, has told county clerks not to follow the law of the United States of America, that they are not obliged to. He has no respect for the Constitution. He is the worst kind of theocrat, the worst kind of, anti-rule of law kind of person I can think of as taking in. On top of that, he's crude. He's offensive. He's a creep. He's a weird guy. So his last rally, I think it was today, featured Bannon and his wife. And his wife reads the statements. This wasn't off the cuff. She reads the statement about, hey, people have accused us of being anti-Jews, but let me tell you, some of our best friends are Jewish. We even have rabbi friends. Really? And then she says, one of our attorneys is a Jew. Really? This is to combat the attacks that they're anti-Semites. This is exactly what every anti-Semite in history has said. Oh, no. I've had friends who are Jewish. Last week Moore said about George Soros, not somebody I'm, very supportive of. George Soros is a really, really bad guy. I promised to do a show on George Soros. I'll do a show on George Soros soon. George Soros, who is Jewish, and he said about George Soros, is going to the same place that people who don't recognize God and morality and accept his salvation are going, which is where I'm going, me, Yaron Brook. And that's not a good place, right? So the whole standard of him is you either recognize God as a Christian or you're going to hell. You're going to hell. Jews are going to hell. Atheists are going to hell. Muslims are going to hell. A lot of people want Muslims to go to hell, but anybody who doesn't, right, who doesn't agree with his Christianity is going to hell. This is the guy with no shame saying this. Now, granted, he's from Alabama, but I think the fact that he flouted the rule of law, that to me is, of all the things that he's been accused of, is the worst. But the guy's a real, and this is the thing. If you'd have elected a Democrat, the guy would have been there for 2 years, and then you would have had a chance.
Less than a year. Mm-hmm. And, he's never done this before. He's never been a politician.
You have a chance of electing a better Republican in the state of Alabama. Now that Roy Moore's there, he's not going to be challenged unless something really bad happens to him. He's not going to be challenged, and in 2 years, he's going to be the nominee again, and he's going to be a senator now for the rest of his life. Luckily, he's 70, so he's not going to live that long, hopefully. But just a horrible, horrible human being. Everything I've seen of him, every time he speaks, everything I've read of him, he's just creepy. And this is the kind of person that Stephen Bannon is going to go around the country trying to get Republicans to vote for. This is going to be this is the biggest danger of the Roy Moore winning, is that this would embolden Stephen Bannon to go around the country and be more aggressive with the kind of candidates. This is exactly the kind of candidate Stephen Bannon loves. This is exactly the kind of candidate he's going to be promoting. And he's going to win more and more because this is the direction the country's heading towards. It's heading towards what Stephen Bannon calls economic nationalism and a revival of America as a Christian nation. That's what Stephen Bannon wants. That's what he's pushing for. And he's got his first success. So All right, on that pessimistic note, we're going to call it an evening. Nobody called with questions, so I'm going to let you guys all go. It's 40 minutes, which is the ideal length for one of these shows. And I'll probably see you tomorrow if there's news. I'm sure there will be something in the news I want to say something about. But so until then, have a great by the way, if you're writing questions in the comments section, just call up. Then you can ask the question. I don't have time to focus on the thing and to take those questions. I'd rather you call in with those questions. Let me just say this. Is Bannon a Christian? And yes, very much so. He's a huge believer in religion, whether he is a practicing religionist or not. Read his speech that he gave at the Vatican about a year before the election. Very, very interesting, where he condemns laissez-faire capitalism and condemns Ayn Rand-like capitalism and believes in a Judeo-Christian type of capitalism. All right. Thanks, everybody. Oh, we should do a show on Steve Bannon one of these days. I've already talked about him so much. Have a good night. Bye.